All right, everyone. Welcome to the Real Estate Game Changer Show. I'm your host, Mike McKay, based in Jacksonville, Florida. And each and every week, we do this show with people who are changing the game of real estate all over the country. And this is a live show, so if anyone has any questions, please put them in the comments for our guests to answer. If anyone is in the Jacksonville area and you've worked in sales and you're thinking about getting into real estate, send me a DM on Instagram. We are hiring acquisitions people. We're looking for three this quarter. So if you're good at sales, send me a message and let's talk. This week on the show, we have Parker Stiles. Parker, welcome to the show.
How you doing? Happy to be here.
Awesome, man. Well, for the people who don't know you, could you tell us about how you got involved in real estate and how that's led you to where you are today?
Yeah, so I got involved in real estate right out of college. I knew that I wanted to be in real estate in some capacity, but obviously there's a lot of different avenues of which way you want to go. Do you want to be a real estate agent in residential or commercial? I feel like that's the first thing people think of with real estate is, I'm going to go be an agent. I got to go get my license. So I did that thing, but I didn't want to be in residential. I wanted to be in commercial. I thought that was new and exciting. And I got a job at a commercial firm working with tenants and landlords in the industrial commercial space. As a lot of us entrepreneurs are, I was impatient and wanted that six-figure income faster than the 2 to 3 years I thought it was going to take me to develop that where I was at. And I was big into personal development. I was reluctantly involved in some multi-level marketing stuff for a little while. That was the beginning of my entrepreneurial journey. And while I'm glad I don't do that for a living now, it definitely built the framework, the mental framework and foundation that I needed to pursue the grind of becoming successful. It's the best way I can script that. But anyway, I did that in commercial job for 6, 7, 8 months or so. I ended up getting fired from that job we won't go down that road, but the quote was that I was too entrepreneurial and they didn't think that their investment in me was going to pay off in the long run. Now, I don't know if handwriting yellow letters at my desk from time to time had anything to do with me getting fired from that job, but maybe you did or didn't. But backing up, I stumbled into the reason I said personal or multi-level marketing is it got me into that personal development realm. It got me listening to all of these people, podcasts, reading books, Audible, and that funneled me into just stumbling into flipping houses, real estate. This was in 2014. Wholesaling really wasn't this big, sexy term that was being thrown around yet. So I was following some guys on rehabbing houses. I'm like, this is my thing. This is what I'm going to do. If I ever get fired or maybe quit or something changes with work, like I'm going to go be a rehabber, but I'm going to go ahead and start and dip my toes in the water like we all try and do. And I actually did get fired from my job and said, okay, here it is. Your wish is my command, right? I talked it into existence somehow. Be careful what you wish for. And so from that point on, it was just spending all day at the house in my sweatpants and sitting on the couch watching YouTube video after YouTube video, podcast after podcast. I was just a sponge absorbing every piece of content that you could think of and developing a business plan, so to speak. One of the guys I was following, though, Matt Terrio with Epic Real Estate Investing, one of his kind of mottos was learn step A and then do step A. Learn step B and then do step B. Instead of we've all heard analysis paralysis and you try and learn the whole thing and there's all these different ways to do it and then you just end up doing nothing. So I really didn't want that to be me and I just wanted to go and start digging in the dirt somewhere and getting traction. And that was what I did. When I got fired, I went back and actually paid some additional money. It definitely wasn't what coaching costs these days. But I did get some one-on-one coaching and I said, hey, I literally just got fired from my job. This is going to be my thing. Tell me what I need to do to make it happen and I'll do whatever you say. And so that was the start. That was December of 2014.
So was the first deal you did a flip?
It was actually a wholesale. I bought it. Sorry. So let's call it a wholetail. It was a wholetail long before that word ever existed.
Yeah.
So I got this quick story on that first deal. It took me 8 months, by the way, to get that first deal. I had talked to hundreds of sellers that did not sound anything like the coaches would tell me these conversations would sound like. They were all FUs and stop mailing me and this is an insulting offer and all these things. Until one day, the first one called me, and I had this conversation with this gentleman, and he was an older guy in his 80s. It was really like 10 minutes down the road from where I was living, and it was an abandoned house. He said, I've got a tear down. They're saying they're going to tear down this property. They're going to put a lien on it for $15,000 after they tear it down. I grew up in this house. My parents raised me in this house. I asked him why he had it. He said, so his cats could go in and out and have somewhere to stay. He didn't actually live there. There was mold from the floor to the ceilings. Place was trashed. It was incredible. It was the first house like this that I had laid eyes on during this journey. And so it was a big deal to me. But I remember what he said on the phone. He said, if you can figure out how to keep this house from being torn down and not get these memories essentially taken away from me, I'll practically give it to you. So he said, and that was the first, that was like the click. That's what these guys are saying. These people are like, so I need to go find more of these people. I said, sir, I don't know how. I hadn't bought a house yet. And now that they're going to tear it down in a week and a half. Long story short, I ended up closing on that house 7 days later. Luckily, it wasn't a super expensive house. The capital wasn't too much of an issue, but I just brought my resources together. I'd been going to RIA meetings within an hour radius, building my network, finding connections. And I called all the people, and those individual connection was just like, I got one. What do I do? And I ended up buying it, closing on it, and I was going to rehab it. And then I went to a seminar actually in California that I had already planned. It was that one of my coach was doing this, Matt Terrio in California. And I met this guy, and he was like, why don't you try and wholesale it? I didn't even know what that was. I'm like, how do you do that? Like, I already bought it. I'm going to rehab it. And he's like, go see if somebody else will go buy it. How much do you think you're going to make on the rehab? And I was like, maybe $40,000 or so. And he's like, what if you could make 20 grand now without doing anything? Would you take that? I was like, sure, definitely. I said, but nobody's going to pay anything more than I paid for it. I ran my numbers, and I've got these spreadsheets and formulas, and like, why would anybody pay more than what I paid? And he's like, why are you negotiating for somebody that's not you? He says, that's a good point. So went back home. I called some people. I put it on Craigslist, and I had that thing sold in 2 weeks, and it was like $17,000 in my checking account. That was the first paycheck. It was the first like, all right, this is real. Game on. Let's go.
Gotcha. So did you jump only into wholesaling after that, or are you still going on a rehab route?
I actually didn't. I stayed rehabbing for the next, 2 years. There were a couple of wholesales trickled in, but I definitely wasn't building that business model. I wanted the before and after pictures. That's all I can say. I don't know why, but apparently that's why I was going through all the stress from contractors taking advantage of me and opening up walls and finding $10,000, $20,000 more in repairs and all these things as to be the HGTV star for some reason.
Yeah.
At least in the beginning.
So what does your business look like today?
Today, we're in a few different markets. So I pulled at that meetup or at that seminar that I mentioned before, I had discovered virtual wholesaling.
And 2014 or 2015?
2014. This guy was talking about how he was flipping houses, toes in the sand, not going into any of them, and he wasn't in any of his markets. And I was like, this sounds pretty cool. I can do this alongside my rehabbing of houses in Atlanta. And fast forward, I set that up. I liked that business because it forced me to delegate. I couldn't do it all myself.
Because you weren't there. Is that
exactly? I was going to pick a market, and I found there was a data guy there, and I asked him after the event. I said, "Hey, I want to do this. Where do I need to go to do this? Where's the best place to do it?" And he could have closed his eyes and picked somewhere on a map, or actually looked at a bunch of data. I don't know. But it landed on Knoxville, Tennessee or Charleston, South Carolina. And I said, Charleston sounds like a more fun place to visit. So let's do that. There was like no real research that went into it. So maybe I got a little lucky there and picked a good place because we're still in Charleston. It's probably our heftiest market that we have. And so Charleston, South Carolina, I had to pull out of Atlanta because all my time and money was going into that. About a year and a half later, I was doing a couple deals a month and had the system and the people, had made a bunch of mistakes there as far as hiring and firing and finding right butt, right seat type of deal. And then once I got that, I copy and pasted what we had and I put it in Atlanta. And then for a few years, we scaled up Atlanta and Charleston together. A couple of years later, we bolted on Columbia, South Carolina. which is about 2 hours from Charleston. So it was plug and play there, not a whole lot of differences. And then we ended up bolting on Charlotte, North Carolina. So Atlanta, Charleston, Columbia, and Charlotte are our markets today. We're primarily in South Carolina, and then I would say Atlanta and Charlotte tail end behind it. And we are a full-scale wholesale shop. That is the fundamental kind of baseline business. And then we've adopted exit strategies over the years to capitalize in other ways on those deals. So imagine a conveyor belt of off-market opportunities coming across your desk on a weekly basis. And then we wholesale to create cash, feed the machine, pay the team, keep the lights on, et cetera, find opportunities. And then we utilize rental properties. We have a private mortgage company for long-term notes. We have a short-term hard money company and just funnel that stuff in for passive income. It's all about trading the active gains into passive streams for us.
And how are you deciding when something is, hey, I'm just going to wholesale this one, or, oh, we're going to renovate this one, or we're going to buy this cash and do a private mortgage on it? How do you decide which strategy to go with on each deal?
For a while, it was spending hours looking at the deal and wasting a ton of time going through different scenarios because I didn't really know. I think the best advice I've gotten in this business is SOP everything out, track it, write it out, make a process, and then give it to somebody to implement and take control over. And so one of those processes in regard to your question is, how do we make decisions on what goes where? What entity is going to be buying it and what's the exit strategy going to be? And so we just wrote these things out as far as if the wholesale is going to be X, then what could we get by wholetailing it? What could we get by rehabbing it? If that's a certain multiple of the wholesale number, for example, if we could rehab it and make 2.5X plus what the wholesale fee was going to be, we're going to take it down and rehab it. If it's going to be 2X or more, we'll take it down and wholetail it if it's the right fit for that. It's going to be vacant at closing. The place is in decent shape. It's not a complete train wreck, et cetera, for the wholetail. And then for a rental property, obviously a little bit more complex calculator that we have built for that. Same thing for the private note or the long-term mortgage. And the hard money is just, that works for the wholesale and the bolt-on. So my goal is having every buyer that buys one of our properties also use our hard money lending company to bolt on and double dip on the profits there. And we can go into detail on any of those exit strategies if you want.
Yeah. Let's talk about the private mortgage one. I haven't heard that many people talk about it in the way that you and I were talking about it offline. So could you share how you approach that?
Definitely. So private notes, being the bank is obviously a killer thing to be. Banks are where the money's made. And I think it is not a one size fits all strategy. I love rental properties. There's some people who are like, I just don't want to be a landlord, and that's okay. I have rental properties and I have properties on owner financing, and I just think they really complement each other well. So we just did one. I'll say that the last two that we did, I'll go through the brief numbers. One was a property we bought for $250,000 in outside of Atlanta. We went in and put about 30 grand into it, painting the walls, changing all the trim work, light fixtures, just lightly updating it. It was already like a 2005 house, so it didn't need a ton. We ended up listing that on the market for, I believe, like 14, and we ended up taking an offer in the high 300s. Now, we write in the description, ask about owner financing for this deal, or seller is offering owner financing to a deserving buyer at a sizable down payment, I believe is the actual terms or verbiage that we use. And so they're asking, and it really just depends on the offer, right? We may have a cash offer that we want to take and not sell it on terms, but getting on the MLS gives you all the options there. It gives you the best amount of offers. And so if it's cash, if that's the best number, we'll take that. But ideally, we want to turn it into a note for that return. And so in this case, the buyer actually put like $300,000 down, $315,000, that they had just sold a property. They didn't want a large debt amount. And I actually almost bought their property that they were going to sell. I talked with the agent and it sounded like a cash deal. And I almost bought that house she was selling to, but I got beat out by Opendoor. So lost it there, but she took all that cash. She put it down for this property. So we were all in it for about 280. She put a little over 300 down. So we profited about 10 grand on the deal. So there's your quasi wholesale fee right there, right? If you're looking at it like that. And then we financed about $100,000 at 9.9% on a 30-year. And I don't know what her payment is. I believe it's somewhere around $600 or $700 a month. And that was a good size for her. She also tried to get debt on her side initially and was unable to due to credit and due to a bankruptcy that had been resolved. And so we ran her through our underwriting process and got her approved for the $100,000. She wouldn't have gotten approved for much more than $100,000, but we did get her more than, I think she only got approved for $50,000 from a FHA lender. Plus, if we sold FHA, we would have had to sit on our hands for a little bit longer as well because of that restriction on timeline for resale. So this helped us, being the bank, helped us in numerous ways. It helped us make money now, upfront at closing, money over the term cash flow, which they call them the three terrible T's with rental properties: tenants, termites, and toilets. We don't have any of those. If her roof's leaking, she's not going to call me. She's just going to go fix her roof. And then money later, when she pays off, if you guys study an amortization calculator, she's probably paying off $5,000 worth of that 100K principal in the first plus or minus 4 to 6 years. So there's going to be a large payoff on the back end as well. Much bigger when you combine everything, the money now, money over the term, and money later, much larger than what we would have made on the rehab. I also have tax benefits from that because I'm not making it all in a lump sum now. I'm getting it over the term. So it's lowering that tax liability or stretching it out at least.
Are you only looking for people to put down like that large of a down payment, or what are your guys' requirements?
We thought we were going to be getting somewhere around 15 to 20% down on this deal. And so that's what we were expecting to get. This one was a little bit different.
So are you just leaving your own cash in these deals, or are you like selling the note on the back end? Like,
great
how are
question.
You?
So on this one, we had a private lender put up 100% of the financing on the front end. So we needed to pay that private lender back.
For your purchase, you mean?
Correct. Yeah. Okay. We had about $280,000 in debt plus interest at 7% annualized. And so we needed to pay that lender back. That lender wasn't willing to stay in the deal long term. And this is one of the struggles with notes, is not leaving your cash in it. Now, we do more of these in Columbia, South Carolina, on properties that are like, we just closed one a couple of weeks ago that we bought it for 40 and sold it for 80, and the seller put 40 down. We don't have any cash in it. There's others that we have where I might have $40,000, $60,000, $100,000 of cash in it. This one being 280, what we were going to do is we were going to do a split note. So hang with me here. On note origination, when we would sell it to the buyer, instead of being one note for 100, or for, in this case, if we got, let's see, 80% of 400,000, let's just call it for easy numbers, let's say the loan was $300,000. So if the note was going to be for 300 grand, we would do two notes. So one note would be for 80% of that 300. And then the second position note would be for 20% of that 300. Now we would go sell the first position note on the secondary market at, we could probably get 90% of par for that. And then
what is par? I'm not familiar with notes. Let's say it was 250, that math is wrong, but 90% of 250, if the loan amount was 50.
So okay. We'd be getting like $225,000 there. And then on top of the down payment and the other monies that came in. So we would use that cash to pay off the lender. And then we would get to hold that second position note, which was still about $450 a month, because it's still, they're both 9.9%. 30-year AM notes. It's just one's in first position, 80% of it. And then the second position is the other 20%. The reason why I like the split note, there's a little bit more steps to it, but you get cash flow immediately from day one. The other way to do that, to get cash back, would be selling a partial. So if you created that one note for $300,000, you could go to the secondary note buyer's market and you wouldn't sell the whole note because you're trying to keep the cash flow. You'd sell maybe 5 years of payments for $280,000. You'd have to run a future value calculation and find out how many months of this, that would probably be like $2,100 a month. How many months of $2,100 a month payments do I have to sell to get $280,000 from an investor? If that ends up being 68 months, then you would do paperwork to sell 68 months of payments. The ACH would go to that note buyer instead of myself. And then on month 69, I still have 25 years left of payments on that mortgage and I got all my money out of it. So imagine stacking these up as you go down the line, and you've got, yes, it's not money now, but you get all your cash back out of the deal. You sold 5 or 6 years of payments of a 30-year term, and then all of a sudden down the road, they start kicking in and you start getting these paychecks from these notes that you still are first position on.
What do they like? They must want some kind of like discount on it or some kind of return though, right? When you're selling those first 5 years of payments. So what's typical? I have no idea about notes.
8%, 9%. It really depends on the asset. So that's one of the factors that that's one of the main factors you're calculating in on your calculation to find out how many payments you need to sell. If the investor wants 9%, then you might have to sell 80 months of payments. If they wanted 7%, if they're okay with a 7% return, you might get away with only selling them 65 payments.
And then you said you prefer, though, the first strategy, the split note, because you get the cash flow basically right away on your portion.
Where I'm at right now, we're building cash flow to cover all of our personal expenses, all of our business expenses. We want to replace all that, get it out of the way. So yeah, right now, I would rather have investments that are bringing me cash flow that I can actually use instead of stuff that may be a strategy we pivot to in the future, where you're just stocking it away for a later day.
Got it. So typically, except on the cheaper homes, right? Typically, you're utilizing one of these strategies so that you can get your money back and then go do it again.
Exactly.
Got it. Okay.
So on the other one, we're in South Carolina, bought it for 40, sold it for 80, a little bit simpler. The seller put $40,000 down. I'm sorry, the buyer put $40,000 down. So that gave me my money back for my purchase price. Now I'm in it for about $11,000 because I had to pay commissions to my team, commissions to the real estate agent. There's some payroll and stuff that needed to be paid that was associated with that deal. So that was about $11,000. So that's my money in on that. And then I'm getting about $350 a month in principal and interest cash flow, which is an incredible cash on cash return. And when the payoff occurs for a long time, it's still going to be around $40,000 because on a 30-year M payment or debt at 9.9% with that amount of principal, it's not going to change much.
And then what is that typically the rate that you're putting on these notes, about 9.9%?
I've got a 7.5. I've got an 8.5. I've got some nines, lower nines, and then the rest are 9.9. Usually it's 9.9. It honestly, I don't know why this is, but it was a little bit more difficult to get 9.9% after rates went up. Before, it was such an arbitrage. And I was like, why would it be more difficult now? But at the end of the day, like, you're providing a service for people to get home ownership and have debt that might not be getting approved for debt elsewhere, or might take an incredible long time to do. This enabled this lady to beat out other buyers that were competing for this deal. So it brought her up to the top of the list as well, as far as seniority for the deal. And I don't have a prepayment penalty. They can go refinance me out in a few years if they're building credit. And we had one payoff yesterday. And it's nice when they pay off. It's a windfall of cash and you get to put it back to work.
Yeah. And then most of these buyers, you're just putting it on the MLS. They're just coming through that way.
Craigslist is good for the cheaper properties. MLS is better for the more expensive properties. A sign in the yard that says seller will finance, no bank qual for qualification is killer for all of them.
Really? Interesting. Okay.
Stellar Wealth Finance, no bank, QUAL, with a phone number and a crappy yellow sign and scribbly handwritten font. You'll light your phone up.
Interesting. And then is that all happening simultaneously, though? It's on the market and you have that sign in the front yard and you're posting it on Craigslist, or you have a tiered approach to it?
All at the same time. So I do have an agent that's working that, and they're doing all of those things, taking the calls. The thing with the agent is you just want them to understand the owner financing process. You want to do some training with them so they can understand how the money works.
Yeah. And you mentioned before you underwrote her. What are your underwriting requirements, or do you just hand that off to a third party?
I've got a registered mortgage loan officer that we push these through. So it is run through an RMLO. We use a guy that is not local to the state, but he's registered and licensed in about 13 or 14 different states. There was a referral for us. And the reason we use it, you don't have to use an RMLO. If you're selling to, we're trying to do these to personal, like selling to actual persons, not entities. So that's something I didn't note. I don't want people buying properties like this for rental properties because I'm pricing it retail. I'm pricing it retail to where there's no cash flow to buy it as a, like you're making a bad decision if you're buying it for a rental property. So I push away those buyers unless they're going to pay cash. I want people that it's the roof over their head that has the least amount of defaults. I follow a guy that has a bunch of these, and the one default he's ever had was the one investor he ever sold one of these properties to. So not saying that's going to be every case, but you definitely think about it differently when it's the roof over your head versus the roof over your tenant's head, and times get tough and you don't want to make your mortgage payment. So it's a different thought process there. But the RMLO process allows it to be Dodd-Frank compliant. On the back end, you're going to have much more difficulty selling a partial, doing a split note or anything like that when you do not have a Dodd-Frank compliant.
I'm not, again, not familiar with notes. Why is that?
Just from Dodd-Frank, when it came out and everybody was being taken advantage of for predatory loans, it's essentially a stamp of approval saying that this borrower has the ability to repay this debt, and you did not try and do anything sleazy to lock somebody into something that they shouldn't have been locking themselves into.
Got it. So the RMLO will get all the stuff from the borrower, and then do they just approve them and then you just go by their underwriting criteria, or do you have to give the RMLO your own underwriting criteria?
I'm underwriting the property and then they're underwriting the borrower 100%. So I'm going off their underwriting 100% because they're agreeing to make the payments. I'm underwriting as far as my loan to values and things like that, to where if I have to take the house back, it's going to be an okay scenario for me. Arguably, it's going to be a better scenario for me, but we don't want that to happen. We want them to repay their debt. And then we want somebody else checking a box that says, hey, based on their income, their credit, their stated, you know, that sometimes when credit is low, they ask for other sources of income. They might ask for bill receipts, Netflix, car payments. They want to see a year, you know, of good history of payments. It's still some sort of a process. So a little hack here is on the purchase agreement for these, you want to include that earnest money is non-refundable once they have decided to buy the property and they agree to move forward with the underwriting process and time is of the essence. So earnest money is refundable if they do not get approved. So that is the only, once they sign a contract with me, the only way that they get their earnest money back is if they do not get approved by my RMLO. And if I decide not to sell the deal to them.
Got it. Because yeah, it's similar. You don't want people not cooperating just to get
out
of.
We had some before that were just like, this is too complicated. I don't want to do this anymore. And it's way less complicated and way faster than tried to go through a bank and provide blood samples and this, that, and the other. But still, when they have low credit, which most of these buyers do have low credit, otherwise they wouldn't be talking to you for private debt in the first place. They have to verify income in some creative ways for it to be Dodd-Frank compliant. And people live busy lives and they get frustrated. And sometimes they'll try and walk away from your deal. But if they've got $2,500 on the line and they agreed that they were going to move forward with, it definitely adds some security.
Yeah, for sure. And then you were mentioning before, obviously you bring in the deal on the kind of the wholesale side of the business. I know you said if you can make 2.5 times flipping it, you'll do that. And then did you say it was 2 times if you're wholetailing it?
2x for the wholetail. Yeah.
In your guys' world, is the wholetail cleaning it up, or is it like just throwing it on the market literally the way you bought it with maybe sending a cleaning person over there?
I was just having this conversation with somebody yesterday. This guy was saying a wholetail for him is 10 grand or less in spend. A wholetail for me is we're not really doing anything other than we might junk it out and do a professional cleaning crew and then take good pictures. But we're not improving the property. If we're improving the property, I think it's a rehab. Might be a little one, but it's, you know, you're still rehabbing the property.
It's even a paint job.
Yeah, so if I'm not having to bring in contractors and, you know, do all that stuff, then like I'm cool with just 2xing the exposure there, the profitability for the increased exposure.
Yeah. How did you guys decide on those numbers or those ratios?
Maybe not the, you know, best answer, but just from experience doing rehabs and, you know, seeing how long stuff can take and then doing some wholetails and seeing how, wow, that didn't turn out the way I thought it was going to. And just what type of numbers do I want to see to go into this, to go on title, to get with insurance, to turn on utilities, to all the stuff. So there's just inherent more risk when it comes to going on title with a property. And that's okay if you're set up for that and are buying. So that's what it all comes down to is, hey, if we're going to wholetail this, cool, but you need to go back and get a $10,000 price reduction to our sales team.
Yeah, gotcha. And then you're in 4 different markets, I think you said. So are you running that virtually in the sense that like your sales team is where you are, or do you have salespeople on the ground in every market?
They're on the ground in all but Atlanta, but mostly majority Charleston. Going forward, all of my hires will be in Charleston. And I like that area. It has become one of my hubs. I've got a guy in Columbia. I've got most of my guys in Charleston. I have a couple guys in Charlotte because we actually opened a brick and mortar office there that we're in the process of shutting down now. We can go into that if you want to. But then my head of operations is in Atlanta, but no salespeople. So they're scattered out because we've been hip-hopping around, but we are centralized on communication with Zoom and other tools that we use for getting stuff done.
Yeah.
I'm in Athens, Georgia, by the way. Yeah. Yes, I forgot to mention that. That's an hour and a half east of Atlanta. So I didn't really want to do anything in my market. I like the idea of not doing any work where I live. Maybe I'm missing out. There's flippers around me. There's stuff happening all over me. Maybe I should have my hand in that bucket, but I'm not having the excuse or the need to have to go check on a rental property or go make sure a rehab's being. And I know that even if I had people for it, if I was here, I'd get sucked into it. And so I'm like insulating myself with hours of drive time. And if I have to go there, it's a damn good reason.
Yeah, let's talk about that was in Charleston. You said somewhere you shut down Charlotte. You shut down a brick and mortar office. What made you decide to open one? And then what made you decide to close it?
I loved the aspect of W-2 team leads and how much more you can get out of someone in an office when you have a manager there working the office, the transfer of communication and the flow of education from one person to the next. And just the overall hype and the energy. And like, I'd see all these guys' Facebook feeds of, you know, spitting the money machine out and spinning the wheel and playing ping pong. And I'm like, that's cool. 1, 2, I don't want an office where I'm at. So I'm not going to be at this office. So I'm going to have the right person to run that office. Rewind, a couple years ago, I hired a guy as a full-time recruiter for our sales team. We hired 50-something acquisitions agents in about 8 or 9 months. It was a
50.
It was a high it was a messy revolving door, loud experience. We were following a certain model that I do believe works in an office, but we were trying to do it virtually, hiring a bunch of people, getting them on the dialer. They'd have tier one, tier two, tier three agents. As they moved up and graduated through the ranks, they got access to different type of leads, direct mail, PPC, et cetera. And we were running group interviews on Indeed a couple times a week with 8 to 15 people on them. And it was a whole thing. But we ended up saying this guy that was the recruiter would be a great fit to run the office, because he kept telling me also, he's like, he ran a 500 seat call floor, had a lot of experience hiring and firing. And over that year period of doing this heavy recruiting model, he was like, dude, if you can get me an office, I can get my hands around these guys' necks and like to get more out of them. Cause he was having people not show up to work and not calling on the dialer, not doing, it's frustrating. When you're trying to get somebody to do something and they say they're going to do it and you're 2 hours away from them and they're Zooming you in their bedroom. And it's just, it's tough to get a lot of juice out of the squeeze. So maybe that when they're new and maybe the culture's not a super right fit for them yet, we were still figuring a lot of stuff out with all of this. And I was like, maybe the office is the answer. So he was in Charlotte. We ended up getting an office in Charlotte. I said, let's give this a go. We hired some people, put them in the office, and went about a year. And I learned a lot from that. I wouldn't take it back. And I met some great people. And that guy that ran the office, he ended up, in my opinion, maybe not being the right fit to run that office, but I didn't want to be the one there running the office either. So that's it. But he's my GM now, and he's the most amazing fit for the tweaked specific role that he's doing now virtually. But we didn't need an office for him to be the GM of the company. And all the people that were in the office, they were cool working from home. So it's just a pivot that we're making to have these people move, work from home, go back to what we know. At the end of the day, it was too many news. It was a new office for us, a new office environment. It was a new market. It was new being that I was not at the office. It was a new manager running an office on his own. And it was just too much new at the same time. And so we closed six figures worth of deals during that time. But based on the spend and the overhead and the noise and the incongruency of how it just didn't really mesh with the other virtual team. I have another sales manager with 5 acquisitions agents that all work from home. We're running and gunning over there. And they just didn't blend as far as pay structure, comp plans, and term, and marketing, and where do the leads go? I just desperately wanted it to be simpler. And I learned for myself that I don't want an office. I've done virtual for so long that I can't go back. And maybe that office would have worked out if there were different people in different seats. That's life. And that was our experience. And we've capitalized on it. And we've got an amazing plan that is really humming along right now.
It's interesting that you mentioned that we're actually in the process of hiring a recruiter to recruit in-house to recruit salespeople now. Any tips or takeaways you can share as I go to hire this person?
How many people are you trying to hire during a certain amount of time?
We're looking to hire 3 sales reps this quarter. So basically in the next 2 months.
Got it. And so is it just a contract deal where after the quarter is up, that hire will go away?
No, they'll be there. We're probably going to hire at least 1 additional sales rep every quarter. And then there'll be some other roles to fill, like project management, other stuff like that. So it'll be a full-time person overseas, but full-time.
Got it. Are they going to be doing any training? Or just recruiting?
Just recruiting. I'll still handle the sales training.
I think that simplifies things a lot. This guy was running the training also, and it becomes a lot, but he was a great sales trainer too. So it just depends on who you're bringing on. If it's just recruiting, really, I think it's somebody that knows how to work systems like Indeed and WiseHire and all those things. I don't know what process, what platform are you going to go with, if not multiple?
We have a lot of stuff up on Indeed now. We're just not getting enough of the quality that I want from there. So actually the purpose of this role is this person's going to build an outbound recruiting strategy, as well as handle, obviously, the stuff for initial screening that come from Indeed.
That's cool. Now, I'd like to hear from you on the outbound stuff, how that works. We really just pressed the button pretty hard on Indeed with spend and there was a couple workaround tricks with Indeed for cost per click way instead of doing the pay per application way, and we do like multiple ads in different cities. And there were some little hacks with Indeed specifically that we were doing, but we did over time, they closed some of those loopholes. And we did see.
I was about to ask exactly what they were.
Yeah. So, sorry for hyping that up there and then letting you down. But we saw the same thing as you. Kind of quality did decrease a little bit. And we were going back to the application route and then just rejecting a bunch of those applications. But they're out there with recruiting. You probably would agree it's hire sales first and teach them real estate versus the other way around. That's, I think if that's the main thing and it's a culture fit, I love the aspect of like multiple round interviews with different people on your team. And maybe it's a Zoom call first, then it's a more formal interview with maybe someone higher up, if not yourself. And then before they get hired, it's a going and getting a couple beers with some of the team members. If you're local or have that ability, the people we hired in the office, we had them come in and hang out at the office and then they might go down and get a snack or something and just like informal. There was not like the hiring manager was not present. They got to ask questions to the team, to someone that was on their level playing field. And they would basically come back to me or come back to my now GM and say, do they think this is they're a good culture fit for our team or not?
The other employees who are hanging out with them would come
correct
back. Interesting.
Some people are just great interviewers and they can trick that can sniff it out sometimes.
Yeah. So your sales team now, it's all virtual.
We do go on some in-person appointments. Well, virtual gets tossed around a lot. And so the way that we're set up is we are in virtual satellite markets. I am not there. So I call it virtual because it screens all day for me, but I do have boots on the ground. And I would say we're 85-15 as far as phone appointments to in-person appointments.
Being phone or got it?
We're pushing and we've gone back and forth. I used to do all in-person appointments. I've done all phone appointments and now we just push. If you have a good conversation and you're within 45 minutes, go drive to their house, go shake a hand, go make eye contact. Because we've proven now to the agents that we have, they know they're going to get a better conversion rate. They know they're going to get deeper discounts on the property and they know they're going to build better rapport with the seller. I got a guy who we call him Mr. Sweet Tea. He'll go out and he's brought a jug of sweet tea and he'll just go sit on a porch step with an old lady and share a glass for 2 hours talking about life and come home with the contract. It's just this deep level rapport.
Wow.
I've got one guy that went to this lady's house, realized that she was a dragonfly fanatic. And she, older lady, probably in her 70s, dragonfly fanatic. He came back the next morning. She had to leave. He said he'd come back to bring the contract. He went to Hobby Lobby and bought a nice box that was like the size of a piece of paper. And it had this crystal dragonfly on the front of it. And he delivered the contract in this $5 box to this lady. And he said she cried, like flipped, like immediate signature. You can't do that stuff over the phone. So I'm not saying we're doing that at every appointment. Those are some of the cool stories, but it definitely gives you that ability to go multiple layers deeper when you are in person. Some of the drawbacks is if you're trying to run real volume, it could hold you back there. I think that's less of an excuse than people try and make it seem sometimes because there's high volume guys doing in person. You just got to set it up right.
Yeah. What's your expectation right now of like your acquisitions reps? What do they need to do every single day? Or what is your sales manager's expectation of them?
Yeah. In the morning, they're waking up and getting their day started. I expect them to get their day started or I'm not monitoring them in their house on cameras. 8:30 or so, getting ready, getting prepared, maybe reading a book. We've got a book club with our book club chat that my sales manager runs. A lot of our guys and girl that we have are into fitness. And so we've got like a fitness workout chat where they're sharing PRs and stuff like that. So that the culture is a big piece to this communication about stuff that's not just work related. And so that's the morning. We stress morning routines. Whatever it is for you, just have one, because doing something consistent at the beginning of each day is just scientifically proven to get you off to a better start. At 9 o'clock, we call that our power hour. From 9 to 10 is time to be on the phones. It's just a determined time of great conversion rates, of answer rates. And so from 9 to 10, we do that. 10-10 every day is our huddle. So our sales manager, if it's on Monday, we run our weekly review call. It's about 30 minutes where we go through all of our metrics from yesterday. We go through our contracts that were signed last week, our contracts that our dispo coordinator put in escrow last week, how much revenue was closed last week, any announcements from any team members. And then we break for the huddle right after that. And then every day after at 10-10 is the sales manager huddle where they're running through their scorecard. We gamified it. So they've got a scorecard that tracks their text, phone calls, offers made, appointments set, contracts signed, a couple other different things. They've got a running, like how much do they have in escrow? How much have they closed this month? There's a daily, like a yesterday's number. And then under it is a month to date that keeps updating. So we see who's, and so we gamified it by its ranked. So each one of those metrics for calls made, dialer attempts made, offers made, things like that, they all have certain point values. And that works into a formula where it gives them an effort metric score for yesterday. And so then we have the conditional terms set on Excel where I have a standard of 50. And it's if they score 50 or higher, it turns green. If they're under 50, it turns red. Nobody likes to see red. So they're competing there. And then it also ranks them 1 through 6. So whoever has the highest score, like they're competing for that top spot as far as the effort metric score. So how we go through those initial ones, and then we cover offers made yesterday and then appointments and offers that are scheduled for today. And my sales manager's pulling up Google Street View and Zillow and comps. And we have an offer approval process that they have to submit pieces of information for him to give that stamp of approval on the offer. And then it goes out and we break. Usually is about an hour call.
Gotcha. And what are you expecting your reps to bring in like per month in terms of like deals or contracts?
I want them being somewhere that this is low in the world of wholesaling, I'll admit. And it's something we're working on. But like I want a guy's closing at least 20 deals a year. If it's under 20 closings, then we're having conversations and they may not be the right fit. But we do about 100 deals a year. So between the agents that we have, probably pushing like 120 or so, I would say would be where we come out this year, if I had to guess. And 3 contracts on average a month, as far as like new signed deals is where I'm happy with them. But they're 1099, they're 100% commission. There'd be different standards if it was W monthly paychecks. Gotcha. But we have I guess for the revenue, they get bonused at 40K. That's the tier point. So if they close under 40K, they get 12% of whatever revenue they close.
Is that per deal? Is that per deal?
If they close 40 grand or more in a month, or 120 grand or more in a calendar quarter, we give them the opportunity to catch it up in a quarter. We'll back pay a bonus of an additional 5% for all of that revenue created. So if they have a crappy January and just do one deal for 25 grand, they're going to get 12%. And then if they crush it in February and March and they close $130,000 or $150,000 total, then we'll go back on all of that 12% paid revenue and up it to 17%. And after somebody's been with us long enough to do $500,000 in gross profits, then we bump them to a senior status and it goes from 15, 20.
Okay, gotcha. And then that 40 is that's a not 40 per month, that's 40 per deal, you were saying, right? If they want to jump right away up at higher.
40 per month. Our average deal size over the last 2 years and a couple hundred deals is like 21.5.
Okay. Got, regardless if it's a wholesale or a wholetail or whatever, it just that's the average number.
We've been primarily wholesale. If you think about the last 2 years is the time of the hedge funds. And so we were wholesaling a lot of stuff, just taking those rips to the hedge funds. Now that interest rates have gone way up as of last year, we started building those contractor relationships again to go take more stuff down, do some rehabs, have some wholetails in there, things like that. Also, I believe thrown in that number is phantom profit. And so if we buy something for a rental, we calculate a phantom profit of what we believe it would have conservatively wholesaled for, helps us pay bonuses and stuff for when we're taking deals down internally.
Yeah. Makes sense. Gotcha. And then so you have all the reps in different markets, and we were talking offline, you guys are doing like a lot of different types of marketing. Are those leads always going to the person who's in that market because you want someone local?
Everybody's sharing.
Okay.
Yeah. Everybody's sharing, but we help each other out. If somebody needs an in-person, like every now and then we'll run across a seller that I'm not signing unless you come to my house and sit down with me and all that stuff. They might partner with an agent that's in that market and they, hey, we'll split the deal or whatever. Usually they can just get it done over the phone. And then we have runners for getting pictures and stuff like that. One thing, a cool little tip that I'll throw out there that really helped us this year is if you're buying virtually, when you go to the house, a lot of times it's not in the condition that the seller said that it was. So you end up having to get a price reduction to make the deal work. Do you get it then and sacrifice once you get your buyers in and you find out you didn't actually get it deep enough because there's more things wrong that you didn't find, but your buyers did find? And then good luck getting a second price reduction. Or do you wait to get the price reduction after all your buyers get in and risk the seller saying no, because by that time they have talked to other options and their real estate half sister has come in and said, oh, hey, if it doesn't sell, I could probably get you $50,000 more than what you signed. So they have all these other options after you've waited that long to go back. There really wasn't a good answer for us except to figure out how to get two price reductions. How do we set the stage if the seller is not honest with us or just simply didn't know or doesn't know about their property? How do we set the stage to not kill rapport and get two price reductions? What we do is at the contract signing time period when we're having, we call it the DocuSign call. So we have the discovery call, which is the initial call. Then 30 minutes later, or whenever they set the appointment time, it's usually 30 to 60 minutes. We have the offer call. We make the offer. And then we have the DocuSign call right after that if they're agreeing to receive the offer. We don't release the number until they're ready to sign. So if they give us any pushback, we hold that offer and that DocuSign call until they say that they're ready, because we know we lose all of our leverage the second we give them our number. So just a little thing there negotiation-wise. But once we offer that DocuSign call, at the end of it, we say, hey, awesome, looking forward to this. This is going to be great. But just to let you know, our next process is to get to the house, get pictures, and start that. You'll be reached out to by two girls on our team, on our transactional coordination team, blah, blah, blah. But if we get to the house and discover that it's not in the condition that you and I discussed about, just want to warn you, my finance team is going to make me get back up on the phone with you and get back to par, so to speak, on the price as far as what we agreed upon. So is there anything else that you think we should know about? Sometimes we'll find out about stuff then. Sometimes we don't. So what happens if we go to the house and it's not, we get the pictures back and we're like, whoa, this is terrible, this, that, the other. Look at this foundation crack and the whatever. So we go back and obviously we're not making stuff up. We can back this stuff up by the pictures that we received, but they're using that as leverage and saying, remember when I said this, I had a meeting with the finance team this morning, this property came up and it's just not what we agreed to pay for. It's not the same condition, or there's this or that, or you said the bathrooms were updated, or you said it was blah, blah, blah. So that's our option. So we're going to have to be $12,000 lower because that's what we thought we were buying. Now, I want to forewarn you, after we get that price reduction, want to let you know.
After they say, okay, that's fair enough, and yes, let's change it.
You say, now just in full transparency, we have not done the inspections yet. This is just pictures. We have not done it. We have not gotten our team inside to do the actual inspections because that's our due diligence. But this is just pictures. We're getting back to par here. If we discover anything during inspections, we're going to have another discussion about any newly found liabilities we might come across. Does that all make sense? We do this. We have that conversation. That was a piece that I left out in that call prior when we're going over the DocuSign agreement with them. So we're essentially just setting the stage. There's two opportunities for a price reduction. If you're A, not being honest, or B, simply just don't know and there's stuff that we find, can we all agree that's fair? And so it's worded a little bit more it's sweetened up a little bit better in our scripting, but that's the gist that you can use that gives you what I've learned doing this is everything is proper expectation setting. So many fires can be just avoided completely if you set better expectations on the front end. Wars could be avoided if we set better communication and better expectations were set up front. Big thing with hiring. It is very hard to get somebody to do something that they didn't think they were initially hiring for or signing up for when it comes to an acquisitions agent or an operations manager and different responsibilities you're wanting to give them. If you tell them all that up front, they will just run through brick walls doing all those things. But the second you change it up and you add something else, you might ruffle some feathers. So it's all about being clear, upfront expectation setting.
Yeah, for sure. And then how are you guys running your dispositions being in so many different markets?
My head of operations she used to be my admin. Then she started doing some dispo for me. Then she started taking over TC. Then I hired a TC VA for her. And we got to about 30 files at one time. And this was last summer. And she called me crying one day, can't do it anymore. I can't do both. She said, I need you to convince me not to quit because I'm just burned out. I can't do this. So it was improper communication on my end. That was proof that I should have communicated better and we should have had a closer tie on that. But that was the moment where I was like, all right, I need a dispositions coordinator. Like I didn't want to do it, but I got to do it now. So we very quickly went out and recruited and found somebody who we believe is a great fit. They've been with us for about 7-8 months now. He's rocking and rolling. He does a lot of investor lift. We have a lieutenant account with investor lift, and that's a big piece to his SOP. We have great email lists from just contacts that I've built over the years in Charleston, Atlanta, and Columbia. So we have twofold, like we're using investor lift to funnel it out to people that are not on our organic list. And then we are adding people by the week, usually around 12 new unique buyers a week, adding to our organic list coming from investor lift. And now that dispositions coordinator, he actually has we call him Dispo Dave. He has a VA of himself or for himself that is helping. Her sole focus is how do I get Dave on the phone with more qualified buyers to set people to get them into showings, get them into walkthroughs and collect offers. So we've got a whole dashboard created in Excel. We call it the Dispo Dashboard. We just found it was a lot easier to organize stuff there than Excel. So all of the real-time stuff is on the Dispo Dashboard as far as property address, exit strategy, how many times has the flyers gone out? What's the under contract price? What's the last marketed price? How many buyer inquiries do you have? And then you click on a hyperlink and go to a tab that's specific for that property. And then you'll see all buyer inquiries and like their offers and have they viewed it or have they not viewed it? Are they no longer interested and stuff like that? And then the Podio platform is used for once we choose a buyer, all the data that we want to save for long-term historical purposes. Who do we choose to sell it to? What did they buy it for? All that stuff goes in our Dispo app of Podio, which is our main CRM for the company.
Gotcha. And then I guess it's all what you said before, proper expectation setting. So are you also, it seems like you're getting a lot of people through the property. Are you also just setting that expectation with the seller ahead of time to make sure there's no issues or?
It's with the seller, we're saying like, we got to get our team inside. It's part of our process. We are saying we have the ability to market the property. So I guess to specifically answer your question, we're being a little bit more vague in that category. I'm not straight up, except for our novations. Strategy, we're letting them know. We're telling them everything. I can't think of the word I'm trying to think of, but we're letting them know everything that we're doing up front. We're being very clear. We're not the buyers. We're listing the property on the MLS. We're using an agent that you're going to be partnered with. Man, that word's killing me. But on the cash deals, this is the process, due diligence period. We're going to get our team in. We're going to go in and inspect the property, make sure that there's nothing in there that you and I haven't talked about. And then we'll push to closing, that's what happens.
Gotcha. Awesome. We're getting close to the end here, and there's always two questions I like to ask at the end. First is, what is the craziest or most uncomfortable situation that you have ever experienced in a real estate deal?
Crazy or uncomfortable? I guess this is kind of both crazy and uncomfortable. It's always uncomfortable when booked profits that you think you're going to make just get ripped right out from under you. So, does that qualify? We have a deal right now where it was about a $30,000 wholesale fee. It's in South Carolina. Property is on John's Island. It's known for having very old heir property, like heir owned property passed down from different multiple generations, very no survey / very old surveys. So the lot lines are really mixed up. And so we needed a survey, not only a survey, but the survey had to be recorded with Charleston County, which is a difficult county to get them to work with you on those surveys. That ended up taking us, that pushed a closing that was supposed to be 2 weeks to make 30 grand out to about 5 months to get it, just to get this, and we had to pay for it. So I had to pay like $3,000 for this survey to get done, filed with the county. We are finally getting it. We got it approved. We got it filed. At first they came back and they're like, oh, we need you to make these changes and edits and this, that, and the other. But we got it done and we were like, I don't know, 5-6 days away from closing. The other heir to the property, so that triggered probate. So probate could be another 3+ months. It's not a super complicated one, but still you're like, almost there, gone. What happens a couple weekends later? I'm going to let you guess.
Another heir?
No.
No.
One more guess.
No. No, that's always the common.
How do you win? I'll throw this little hack out there. We have in our contract a stipulation that says if there is a total loss of the property or an insurance claim on the property, we have the ability to take over the insurance claim proceeds as long as there is an overage on top of what we originally agreed to pay the seller. This actually made me about double and one and a half times the assignment fee, what it was going to be when another house burned down last summer, like another week before closing. And instead of making like a $21,000 assignment fee, we made like $35,000 from the insurance proceeds. So cool little thing there. I didn't even know I had it in my contract for 5, 6, 7 years. Didn't even know it was there. And then the house burned down and I was like, wait a minute. Don't I have something in there that says something about casualty or loss? Or did a bunch of research and figured out it worked. So that property, I don't know if that's going to work out because we did just hear back that the max payout would actually be less than what they or what we were going to pay them for their purchase price. So I don't know how that one's going to work, but I know I need to figure out at least how to get my $3,000 paid for somehow for the surveyor. I may be out on that. So that was one that you get kicked in the shins. And then when you're down, you get kicked in the gut. And it's just overall frustrating. I said it to my wife the other day. I haven't been in a bunch of other businesses, so this may be naive to say, but I feel like that this is the best business at allowing you to lock in income and then just finding dozens and dozens of new ways every year to just creatively rip it out from under you.
Yeah. Jeez. I have not had any houses burn down, knock on wood. So
hope it stays that way.
I hope it stays that way. Second question I always ask is if you could go back in time when you were looking for your first deal, give yourself one piece of advice, knowing what you know now, what would you tell yourself?
I think I was just too anxious to get the deal in the beginning. So probably I would have gotten myself better sales training sooner. Like a big thing for us is same-sided selling and going for the no. So if John Martinez, I'll rephrase that. If you don't know John Martinez, go find him on YouTube. And I think Garrett, he sold his education company to somebody else. I don't know if you know his name, but
Jerry Green.
Jerry, right? Yeah. Go get access to his stuff, incredible stuff. But the overall mindset is go for the no. Don't be too eager. Don't have commission breath. You're trying to push sellers away from you. versus just trying to sell them. The analogy of the bully on the schoolyard, the girl and boyfriend, like you're trying to chase the girls are running away from you. But if you're playing hard to get, that kind of deal, but it really does work. So I probably had a lot of commission breath early days. So going and getting some sales training, realizing that mentality that if you are a wholesaler and your business is generating off-market leads to go dispo in whatever fashion, doesn't have to be wholesale, it could be whatever. But if you're in the lead gen business, you are in sales and marketing, not real estate. So go get sales training up front. That's probably same thing with hiring sales first, teaching real estate second, all of that stuff rolls together. So I think I did a ton of real estate training in the beginning, multiple years before I even started looking at sales stuff.
Yeah, that's an awesome piece of advice. If people want to reach out to you after the show, maybe they want to get on your buyer's list or they just want to connect you with you, how can they go about doing that?
Yeah, so buyer's list would be barringtonwholesale.com. And you can find me on Facebook, Parker Styles.
Cool. Awesome, man. Thanks for being on the show.
Thank you. See you.